This episode of Current Geek would not be possible if it wasn't for your support at patreon.com/frogpants. And it's not just this show, it's all the Frog Pants goodness that you've come to know and love. Honestly, we can't do it without your support. You guys are amazing. Keep it up. Those who already have done it, thank you. For those who haven't yet, hey, consider it. Go to patreon.com/frogpants.
There will be a day when the hate against Google Hangouts will fail.
But today
is not that day.
I have
Current Geek!
Hello, everybody. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is Current Geek, the weekly proceedings of the meetings of the Frog Pants All-Stars. Geeks of the world and you, to keep you current on all things that matter most. I'm Scott Johnson. That's Tom Merritt.
Hello, Scott Johnson.
Hello. How are you today?
I feel very 2015. I'm all into 2015. I'm comfortable in it, wearing it like a new skin.
I kind of am, too. I don't like some of it always seems to happen in January, but something nasty will happen at the top of the year, and we are thinking about our French listeners and friends who are over the seas, and stand in solidarity with them during this rough time. But it always seems like January wants to stick us with something gnarly like that. Yet I'm still strangely optimistic about 2015 in a lot of ways. It's an exciting year.
You're right. 2015 kind of sucks.
I know, so far. But look, there's time.
Never mind. I'm tired. I'm done with 2015.
Just call it January. January, you suck. Except for CES coverage.
January isn't always bad, is it?
Is it ever good? When's it good? Name me a January.
Let's look at the evidence.
All right. This is what you always do, though. See, I'm just
going
off.
Well, you know who's good about that?
Who's that?
Roger Chang.
Wait, we should have had him on the show. Oh, shoot. Look, we have on the show with us tonight a very special guest. He's been on before. He's on again. Ladies and gentlemen, Roger Chang. Hey, Roger.
Hello.
It's good to have you, man. Good to have you here.
I agree with Tom. 2015 does suck.
Yeah, it kind of sucks so far. So far. I mean, I don't
know. Although at the end of the month, it should be better, at least for me.
How's the... Oh, that's right. You got a baby coming. Yeah.
Baby coming. And then February will probably go back down as I lose sleep.
That's true. Congrats, by the way. That's very exciting.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Having kids is great.
2015 is one of those. I mean, at least if you're one of those people that divine tea leaves or whatever, I mean, at least the way it's gotten started off, it seems pretty rickety. You got low oil prices. You have deflation in the Eurozone. You've had...
lower prices are good, Roger.
Yeah, explain yourself. Actually, I really like this explanation because a lot of people do hear on the surface that, wait, oil prices are lower. Finally, gas is getting to where it should be. But you say, no, that's instability with its name written on its face or something. So
it's good for some people. And it's bad for very important people. It's bad for the oil producers. But it's also because so much money is tied up into it that it does kind of push the deflationary point for a lot of countries that are already still trying to kind of pull themselves out of the rubble of the 2008 stock market financial meltdown.
Yeah.
And so, for people not familiar with deflation, it's exactly the opposite of inflation. That means prices go down, which sounds good on the surface. But the theory behind, why deflation is a bad thing is that people won't spend because they think, well, next week the prices will be 5% cheaper and so on and so on. Mm. The knockoff effect is that the store that buys the milk from the local dairy says, well, you know what? I'm not going to put in as much order for milk or eggs for your farm because, I don't anticipate selling as much next week. And so the farmer or the grower or the producer says, well, I'm not going to need that much feed. I'm not going to need that much antibiotics or water or whatever I need to cover man. So this huge chain of people that are involved in the process that you don't necessarily see get affected along the way. And it's kind of a vicious cycle because, a company that doesn't, needs to let go of some people because it can no longer afford to pay their wages because, sales are low,
sure,
means that those people no longer have the extra income to spend on stuff, and so it's a domino effect, and that's why economists are so very wary of what they call a deflationary spiral.
Yeah, I don't like none of that. Sounds like Back to the Future 2 to me at all. Which
sounds like East Meets West to me.
I'm sorry.
You got I never get to tell you guys this in the same room, but did you know I listen to a lot of podcasts? It's one of my favorite shows.
You're the listener?
Yeah, I love it. I always
so nice to meet you.
I always enjoy it. I always have. It was an early one, and I've just every time I've seen it stick around, it's exciting. I got to one time be on it as a co-host when you were out of town, Tom, and I was on with Roger once. It was a long time ago.
We talked about Star Trek bathrooms.
We did. Finally, somebody approached that subject with care. But yeah, I love that show. And so what you just got a taste of there, dear listener, is a lot of what you can find at East Meets West. And I recommend that show a lot. It's good. It's where East meets West. And you'll find out why if you tune in.
We're secretly recording an episode during Current Geek.
Look at you.
I'm just going to go pull out the parts.
Hey, that'd be kind of cool if you had the technology. You could kind of simultaneously do two and do kind of a subliminal second
like steganography.
Recording.
Yeah, why not? There's somebody that's a brilliant way to do it. It's the new wave of podcasting. You know, it's back, everybody. So
you just got to play the recording backwards. And you'll hear.
Paul is dead. All right. Well, hey, what's up here with the news? I don't know. Maybe some top of the show stuff. Let's find out.
Herbert Hoover, Secretary of Commerce in 1922, finds infant radio facilitates news gathering, as do many others in high public office.
Tom, what's on the docket today?
Well, the big news this week was CES, the Cleveland Electronics Show, where people break into closed circuit cities and look for Palm Life Drives. actually, all credit for that joke to Rich Stroffolino, who just posted that on Twitter 3 minutes ago. That's hilarious.
That's pretty good.
No, yeah. CES, the Consumer Electronics Show. You like TVs? Mm. Hey, we got them. Mm. Also, the Internet of Things, self-driving cars. I'm sorry, advanced driver assistance systems. And all kinds of other stuff. Roger, hold off on drones for a moment. But outside of that, what was your favorite thing at CES?
You know, I'm not a phone guy. I'm kind of late to the game on, smartphones. I can get apps. I can do this. But I really love photography. And what really kind of got me excited was the new crop of camera phones. Panasonic released one. But the one that really got me was the Asus Zenfone Zoom with the 3X optical stabilized zoom. And the reason why is when I take a picture of something or event, I either have to have people stand, for a good 30 seconds so they don't come out too blurry,
sure.
Even with a flash, or if it's a dark room or whatever. Just having a really good camera, I think, would add an immeasurable amount of at least personal joy when I take a snap and I put it up on Facebook and I'm not annoyed that everything's so pixelated or blurry or a little lo-fi.
That stuff's getting better and better, but it's funny when you say Asus as a brand. Still, to me, Asus never got out of that's the motherboard I should buy and into these other products that they're now, quite frankly, excelling in.
The monitor at my dentist yesterday was an Asus.
Yeah, see, that shocks me when I see those.
It's
things.
A huge company in Taiwan. It's,
yeah, they're enormous now.
I mean, a lot of companies, not Lenovo, but Vizio, shocked me a couple of CESs ago when they introduced a line of all-in-one desktop PCs and laptops.
Oh, whoa. How'd that go then? Did that work out, though? Because I haven't heard anything since.
I assume they're still selling them, probably not in this market, mainly because at this point there's no way to make money off one product line or one kind of product category. You really have to spread yourself out because there is incredibly thin margins on a lot of these products, especially TVs. And so, you got to sell something. And for the longest time, smartphones were it. I mean, that was the big growth thing for Samsung, LG, to a lesser extent, Sony and a lot of the other Japanese consumer electronics firms, because, that's what people were buying. People had the one TV. It's like, okay, I'm done. I don't need to buy another TV. But you got a new phone. I can add, some G-Wiz app or some other feature on it. That's great. I get a bigger screen. It's faster. I get real-time GPS updates. I have a sexy voice talking to me. Navigating me, to the pizza parlor or something.
That sounds like the perfect weekend to me.
Do you use the boy band voice on Waze?
No. I actually, so believe it or not, I'm a fan of the show. You actually don't have to believe it, or Sleepy Hollow. And they actually make a Waze voice just for him using the lead character, Ichabod Crane.
Oh, no way.
And he says on the Waze, it's like, turn your carriage to the right. Turn your carriage to the left.
Wow, that's
amazing.
It's just
really keeping a character, and it's a fun way that they've integrated a freebie into their product with a popular TV show.
Well, how different is that from, say, what Garmin and I can't think of some of the others have been doing for a few years where they're Darth Vader's the voice or whatever. It's sort of the same thing, just an
Tom
easy...
Tom's done that a long time ago. Yeah, they've all been doing it. There was a big deal with Ride Along. They had a partnership with Waze for special voices.
Mm. Well,
it's pretty cool. I mean, it's a nice way to customize it. I'm sure at some point it gets annoying.
Yeah.
Because sometimes it's just like, do I turn left here? Do I turn left here?
So, okay, you liked a phone.
I liked a phone.
Which is a little unusual. Most people, because there aren't a lot of phones that are announces. In fact, the one that everybody was talking about is the one that won the best of CES, which is the LG Flex, which is just a successor to the Flex, to the previous Flex, but it's, you know, it's got some nicer specs, better screen, etc. There was the Dell Venue 8 7000 tablet, one best mobile device, which is, I think, very telling of the state of tablets.
Yeah.
But what about the Internet of Things? What about all of these, like these smart light bulbs that can speak to your bed, know when you get up and turn the lights on for you and simulate sunsets and... There was all kinds of Internet of Things stuff. Did either of you get excited about any of that?
Well, I'm curious, Roger, where you're at. My main thing, and I mentioned it when you were on the morning show on Wednesday, Tom, was that I feel like this is, again, one of those promises that have been around forever. Let's automate the house. Let's have everything talk to each other. Have them all connect to the Internet in meaningful ways. All of that stuff sounds great. And it's always sounded great. Just like VR has always sounded great. But in execution, it was always a little janky, a little, you know, thrown together. If you were going to make it work, there were differing standards. What's different now than then?
I think it's more ubiquitous in that it's in more devices. It's no longer just like automate my lights, automate my thermostat, automate, you know, my hot water usage. You know, one of the more interesting things they showed off, and I'm trying to find it right now, is a pacifier that has a built-in thermometer that you can monitor and quote-unquote manage your baby through your network. So, like, I guess if you're not next to your child and they're sleeping, you can keep. And this is the thing. It's both a boon, but it's also, I think, I don't want to say it's a gimmick, but you know, it does give a false sense of control over things that you genuinely may or may not have control over. It's, you know, having a pacifier that you can remotely monitor like you can with a camera. Like we got a drop cam, you know, for the baby and all that. It's great because it allows you to do a lot of things that, oh, I don't need to, you know, I can feel safe. I can feel secure because I can look at it on my phone. But, you know, it's great that you can monitor it, but what can you do if you're at a distance?
Right? So you're in the office or something, and you see your phone beeps, it sends you a notification, baby's temperature is up a degree.
I'm at home. What can I can call the babysitter. I can call, you know, maybe my parent or whatever. But it's at the same time, you know, a lot of that just might be noise. Like, you know, babies might get a temperature, might be normal for them. And you might literally be inundated with information that isn't really useful to you, but it's useful to the manufacturer because they've made it and they need to sell it to you.
Sure. And there's also this question of like, all right, let's keep using the baby thermometer idea. Let's say that Binky falls out of the baby's mouth mid nap and gets wedged between the where the elbow folds, and now it's sleeping on it and the temperature spikes because it's covered in a blanket. It's super hot. It shouldn't be. Baby's sweating all over that thing. As far as you know, you're at the work and this thing's going off like crazy. Oh no, it's up 3 degrees, and you're kind of freaking out. Well, then you got to have a camera to tell you that. I can see that the Binky fell out, but no, not at this angle. Well, I guess I'll need another camera to tell me at a different angle where that Binky went.
Wait, isn't there somebody with the baby? I mean, the baby's not home alone, right? Well,
but that's a good point. But that, I mean, yes, and that's my thing is that these are all great, interesting ideas, but I don't know. In practicality, how useful it is. The company is called Blue Maestro, and the product is called the Pacif I. So PACIF-I, the smart right. pacifier.
Yeah, nice.
It's Bluetooth based, and you know it's great. I mean, I would love to get some of those Wi-Fi enabled light bulbs with
the Misfit Bolt.
Yes, which
no
are great.
No hub necessary, but they can still talk to other devices.
Yeah, and you know, it's fun. I would even get the one with the hub. I mean, before I was actually thinking about actually automating the actual electrical circuit, right? You just splice it, and you know, it's kind of dirty if you don't know what you're doing, potentially dangerous. Splice the line, you put the box in or whatever. But at the same time, it's like, you know what? I have a $15, you know, automated, you know, plug outlet switch that I plug my lamp into, and I set the time, and it's been working perfectly for about the past 5 years. You know,
can you adjust it from your smartphone, Roger? I don't think so.
But do you need to adjust it from your smartphone?
No, and you know, we had a long conversation about this on DTNS earlier this week, and we're really not sure what Internet of Things is good for, but I'm sure it's good for something. And so it's really easy to take pot shots and ridicule all this stuff, kind of the same way that you could take pot shots and ridicule personal computers in the 80s, right? In fact, Patrick Norton told a great story about how the computers were being marketed as put your recipes on there. And he's like, my mom's never going to take her recipes off the cards in her recipe box and put them on a computer that isn't even in the kitchen. Doesn't make any sense, right? Yeah. But computers ended up making sense for a lot of things. I think we're still trying to try out all this stuff. You know, is a light bulb that connects with a smart bed and knows when you're waking up that to give you a nice, like, easy morning glow to help wake you up along with the alarm clock plan? Is that what we want? Does that work or no? Is it the door that knows it's you coming and makes it easier for you to unlock? Is that it? We don't know. We got to try all this stuff out. And I think we're finally at the point where there's enough different kinds of things out there that enough people will try them that we'll start to see in the next couple of years. Oh, that's the use cases that actually make sense.
Well, that's how this stuff usually falls out, right? Like even VR will do that. And we're finally to a point where we did a bunch of experimenting in the 90s and it was kind of crappy and behind the technology curve. And we didn't know anything about motion control or presence or any of the stuff they're talking about now. But finally, the tech meets practicality in some ways. Turns out it may be gaming and some other things, but you know, finally there's a place for it to meet and make economic sense. Surely some of this stuff will stick. I have no doubt, but whether it's ready this year or not, I have questions about that.
I definitely agree with you that it's in its infancy, the tech, not to make a pun about the pacifier, but
it's literally good. In your infant.
That's
it's
right.
The when pass it, I
and mass, fire. When Amazon makes one, it'll be the fire pacifier. All right. Anyway, go ahead.
I mean, you know, as the technology becomes more prevalent, it becomes more interoperable. I mean, like for example, Belkin has their Wemo line, and one of the great things about Wemo is it works with if then this that, so you can literally set up your programming, your schedule, or you know, set it up on a website, and it will, the device, whatever device you use, will take it and will automatically adjust it. So turn on the light, you know, during the winter, it turns on the light sooner. And then the summer, it'll turn the light on later. And then it'll adjust for, you know, daylight savings time. Or if like during a week you have, you ran out your house to Airbnb and you have people stay over and you're out somewhere else, you can have all that too. I think what we will see is where people are using one device with another in a kind of unconventional way that we're not thinking of. Because like you were saying with the PC really didn't have its worth until it became interconnected with the internet.
Yeah.
Where people could literally literally send information from one person to another in an incredibly short amount of time.
It was pretty good at spreadsheets, but that was about it.
Yeah. Yeah. And then, you know, there's the baby step of networking it locally and then having, you know, businesses tied together so that their workflows were connected. And then that next step, the internet just made it so, now this is the future. And everything else is kind of modeled on that. So the idea that common everyday devices or things will follow suit, if that truly is going to be our connective tissue, that makes perfect sense to me. Just having it all happen at once as, you know, reported in January and have that by the end of 2015 seems crazy. Maybe nobody's claiming that, but, you know, this idea that all my things will be connected to the internet anytime soon seems crazy. But I am not against this as an eventuality. It just seems like that will be the way of things. That's how we'll be connected with everything we do.
I figure it'll probably start with health-related industries. For example, like, say you've had heart surgery and you have a pacemaker or whatever. You can wear your fitness watch or whatever. It could give updates and send them off to your physician. And then he can monitor on his screen. It's like, okay, you know, Joe jogged whatever so many miles today, but I noticed, you know, a slight variance in his heartbeat at this point. Maybe, you know, he should come in because he might have heart, you know, he might have arrhythmia or something else that we need to check. I see that as being kind of the vanguard of that being of that kind of pushing in, where people can, you know, have someone else monitor their stuff who might be in a much better position to evaluate the information. Or, for example, like say your CPA. It's like, I noticed you drive a lot to this Walgreens to pick up your prescription. You know, there's a much closer one, and if you just did that the entire year, you would save yourself around $500 in unnecessary.
Stop bossing me around, CPA. I'll do what I want. Sorry.
No. Well, I mean, enjoyed it. You know, it's, or, you know, you can, you know, if you're very concerned about, say, an elderly parent, and you kind of want to keep, you know, if you've had grandparents who've been on the declining side, either because they had dementia or Alzheimer's, and you're worried about them, but you don't necessarily want to kind of lock them in their house, saying, don't ever leave the house because I'm afraid something might happen to you, you might be able to monitor them that way. Or children, where it's like, okay, you can go play outside, just wear these bracelets so I can keep track of you. And it's kind of creepy on one hand because it is very Big Brother-y. Mm. On the other hand, it does give you a peace of mind of being able to kind of you know where certain people are at certain times of the day.
Yeah.
Or like a cheating husband, put it on that ankle bracelet.
It's easy. I use Find My iPhone in this way sometimes.
Find your cheating husband?
Well, no, to know where my kids are, not because I don't know where they are. They're cheating or lying. It's not that so much, but like I wanted to know where they had this field trip. I didn't know where they were going because no one told us. We're like, crap, where are they, at the U or the university? Are they somewhere else? They were going on some tour. And I thought, well, I'll just use that and find out. And both their phones, they were on the same field trip. They were both in the same place. They were up at the University of Utah. And I was like, ah, all right. Well, we know where they're at. Hey, Kim, don't worry. They're at the U. Blah, blah, blah. So things like that are really cool tools as parents or whatever. Be great to have for a dog. You know, the Internet of Things would work great. Your dog's in Wi-Fi access range somewhere. Boom, I know where Fido is. He's not lost anymore. He's down by the Starbucks or whatever. Like I think there's some other cool things that could come out of all this, but there are going to be a bunch of people who are worried about all this stuff being connected, and somehow your iron is sending information to Roger at night and he's sneakily getting your passwords or something weird like
that's
that.
That's already, yeah.
Well,
you
I
don't
know.
Start your shirts, Tom. Your iron told me.
You'll pay the iron price for that.
Oh, I knew you were going there. Somebody
hey,
had to.
What about drones, Roger? I didn't let you answer with drones earlier, and I know that you felt a little sad that you missed the drone rodeo.
Yeah.
The drone rodeo was this little event that was held as part I should remember this company, that they held that The Verge went to, and I was reading up on it, and you know they allowed you to control these drones, and you would wear, you would basically look through a monitor or a headset, and you would control the drone, and you would go through a race course, you know, or an obstacle course, and you would control it. And you would see it from the drone's point of view. And I thought that was just like the most awesome thing. Like, if you wanted virtual reality that actually meant something, that would be it. Because you're actually physically controlling something, and you're in your safe position, but you can see directly what the drone sees. And I think drones will be kind of the big is becoming the big growth area, not just for, you know, peeping Toms or Amazon.
Hey, I prefer the term voyeur, please.
Or Amazon delivery, but for a lot of different industries, specifically ones that require imaging tools to access hard to reach locations. Farmers, video or film crews that want to get kind of that shot without having to rent a cherry picker, mm-hmm. or a very
well, yeah. And along those lines, although it's not a hard to reach location, AirDog won best of CES in the drone category from Engadget because it tracks you. You put either a Sony or a GoPro camera on it, and then it flies around and follows you while you do whatever it is you're doing. So they use Tony Hawk as an example.
I missed that. That's so cool. For real? I had no idea. Yeah. That's very interesting to me. Because I can't fly those things to save my life. I've tried and I crashed them. The idea that it would just follow me around is a pretty rad idea. Unless I, you know, went under a bridge or something and smacked into it.
It kind of reminds me a little bit of, you know, when you play World of Warcraft, you have your familiar, mm-hmm. or whatever. That just totally seems like it.
Yeah, your pet following you around. That's,
you know,
that's
I'm waiting for people to customize them and put like a cat's face or like, you know, a smiley face, like, so it just feels like a more than just a smart, you know, device. It's an actual breathing thing, and then you can combine it with a Tamagotchi or something.
Yeah,
oh, it'd be like the golden compass. It's your demon.
Sure.
Oh, yes.
I noticed that there were enough drones at this event that I say this kind of jokingly, but I started to wonder when they would announce drones that would bring me more drones. That seemed to be the thing at CES. Everyone's making a drone, and that's like the hot new business. Does this force like the FAA to get real stringent on rules and change a bunch of stuff and make it so you can't just go to the park across the street and fly one of these things? Like, I feel like we're getting close to that where these things can be used for real gnarly business if you wanted. You could fly it into an engine of a plane. You could.
Well, okay. But before you go off a cliff with this, let's let people know the reality of the situation, which is that the FAA is in the process of putting together rules for the use of drones. So far, what they've said is we are banning any commercial use of drones without special permission. And you have to follow these guidelines, which include having a pilot's license and this and that. So the problem isn't that people out there with drones are going to start flying these into the butts of planes. Certainly that's a possibility, but that the problem is the opposite. The problem is that the FAA is not allowing anybody to do anything interesting with drones other than being a hobbyist. Mm. Essentially, you can be a hobbyist that flies them in the park, but pretty much any law enforcement official can come and ask you to stop flying your drone pretty much anywhere, and you don't have much of a defense to say, I have the right to do it right now. Mm. So hopefully the FAA will put some real guidelines into place by the end of this year.
That'd be nice,
And part of it, I mean, is just like, it's an entirely new sector of aviation. You've had hobbyist RC model plane pilots for the longest time, and they've had stipulations. I think you have to stand 400 feet.
Yeah, in fact, the people who have worked on those model plane regulations have been dying to help the FAA come up with useful rules. And they've essentially been pointed at as like, yeah, listen to those guys for the time being. But the FAA is really moving slowly.
Do you think it's because, not to get too much deeper on the topic, but do you think it's because drones have so much more maneuverability, cameras, multiple cameras?
What question are you asking? Is you're talking about the delay in the FAA putting rules together?
Well, that for decades they didn't care about RC plane hobbyists, but now suddenly they care about this. More, or it seems to be.
I think it's because of popularity. Mm. Like, there've always been RC model plane hobbyists, but their numbers were relatively few to the population.
Yeah, the need for the rules is because of popularity and because of the added functionality. You guys are both right about that, I think.
Okay.
The dragging the feet is because it's the FAA and they never do anything fast.
All right.
And, you know, it's...
Shots fired.
You know, they're coming at it from a very kind of safety-oriented perspective. You know, airplanes, people on board, you got to be safe. As opposed to drones, you know, may or may not prove a hazard. What if you fly one into the side of a wall and it's 100 feet up and it drops down and, you know, the whole thing weighs about 25 pounds. 25 pounds from 100 feet could be fatal, you know, depending, you know, on where it hits a person. And so, you know, it's not just the FAA. A lot of cities are coming up with ordinances about regulating drones because, you know, you don't want a peeping voyeur, popping up through the bushes, you know, especially with you know, if you think of not that celebrities are in danger or anything, but celebrities often have very tall gardens with, you know, very tall trees and stuff to purposely block out paparazzi or anyone else who might be able to view in. And, you know, yeah, one or two people might be able to rent a helicopter and fly over your, you know, Malibu beach house and look straight in. But, you know, you can hear that coming, one. Two, not a lot of people can afford it. A lot of people can afford a drone. You don't always hear it. And then you got this little thing buzzing over your private pool party where you're trying to, you know, you're trying to relax. You don't want to have photos taken. People are just like, you know, surreptitiously taking photos of you without your permission. You know, there's a lot of privacy and multiple conflicting interests.
I mean, the point is not that there aren't issues to resolve. Of course there are. The point is that the response so far to the fact that there are issues is, so we're not going to allow much of anything.
Mm.
to happen. It's been, you know, the National Park Service tried to shut down the use of any kind of drones in the park.
Yeah.
Which, okay, I don't want hundreds of drones flying over me while I'm trying to take a nice peaceful hike in the park. So I do want rules, but saying, therefore, no one with a GoPro on a drone can ever use it to take beauty shots in the park. Well, that's going too far the other way.
Yeah. I mean, I'm telling you, man, some of our Yosemite was made for a drone to go take pictures. Like, in a way, this is a huge boon to the kind of observation we can make of natural beauty.
And we are not going to get, kind of like Internet of Things that we were talking about earlier, we're not going to know the best uses of drones unless we let a lot of people use them and experiment and try to find out what they're good for. Right?
Yeah.
Responsibly, right? Yeah. Not like flying them into jet planes, but have reasonable rules that will allow people to experiment and try them out and figure out like what the best uses are. We're going to find out all kinds of cool things.
I'm going to draw something based on drone responsibility. Drone responsibly is a pretty good slogan.
Yes.
Actually. So
you'll have
Internet drone responsibly when you drone and tell people that they should be responsible.
Once you add an internet connection and you combine it with like, hey, when the lights turn off, the drone starts up, flies out.
Oh, weird.
It would be great. One thing I can think of a perfect use of it is to chase away, especially my backyard. I got a bunch of oversized squirrels and raccoons that, I don't know, I guess they party back there or something because they make a racket.
Yeah.
Just go in there and just, you know, the motion detectors, I would set up motion detectors. It would detect them and the drones would pop out and chase them away.
Yeah, why not? I mean, that's actually kind of a practical idea. Motion tracking kicks in, drone goes up, tracks the small moving images. They finally go away. We get good at it resetting back to its place of launch after there's no more threat. Like, that's all cool.
And then Skynet happens and we're all...
Oh, dude, totally. All right. Well...
All right. That's a lot of CES.
That is a lot of CES.
Let's move on to one of the stories submitted on our subreddit at currentgeek.reddit.com. I find it especially appropriate that this one was submitted by Mike P. Kennedy.
Mm. Oh, Tom.
Bill Gates funded OmniProcessor, a building size machine exists that boils sewer sludge, burns the dried sludge to create steam, which then powers a steam engine to make electricity. Part of that electricity is used to power the machine. Part of it is fed back into the grid. And then the steam is cleaned through filters to become pure drinking water, which Bill Gates drank in a video promoting the project.
He sipped it.
Janicki Bioenergy created the machine, which is scheduled for a pilot run in Senegal later this year.
He sipped it, then he yacked it in a bucket, but he still sipped it.
Not yacked it in a bucket. There's no evidence that he yacked it in a bucket.
It's actually a very, very ingenious device. And I think one of the underpinnings, I thought this was kind of an aha slap, slap myself in the forehead moment, was that things that work in the developed world do not work in the developing world because... You can't say, well, just lay out a sewage system. Well, you need the infrastructure, you need roads, you need trained people, you need a central government that's has it together to run it efficiently, not prone to corruption and, have things stolen. And this is actually, I'm not sure if either one of you've seen the device working, but it looks very much like a Rube Goldberg device. Just has these, the sludge comes in one hand, it goes up on a conveyor belt
through a tube.
Yeah,
awesome.
It's ingenious because it incentivizes the entire process. The person who owns or runs the machine can make money off the water that gets produced, the electricity or power that gets produced by the machine. I think you can use the ash as fertilizer. I'm not sure if I might be mistaken on that part. But the whole point is that whoever runs it, there's an incentive. They make money off of it.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, they're more liable. They're more likely to keep it running.
Sure.
In good condition because it does bring income for them. As opposed to a government that might be a little overstretched. It's one of those things that's going to get kind of buried under a bunch of other pressing needs schools or law and order, the economy, things like that can get buried in the bureaucracy. And if you enable a community to run one of these, you know, everyone benefits, I think,
yeah,
from it.
Go ahead, Tom.
This kind of thing already exists. In fact, we had a listener on DTNS email us like, hey, Singapore has been doing something like this for a long time. The idea behind this isn't new. It's that it's cheaper and yes. it has these other benefits of being sort of self-sufficient and being able to sell money, you know, or electricity back to the grid to make money to fund itself.
Yeah.
Yeah. The concept is not new. This is an old concept. But what is new is that it is it's more compact and more easily deployable unit in regions where you don't have, you know, a lot of the infrastructure that a developed nation would.
Yeah.
And if you're feeling icky about it, Scott, just remember what Randall Monroe said in the XKCD comic.
Yeah.
Every drop of water you drink was peed out by a dinosaur once.
That's absolutely true. Also,
might not have been peed out, might have come out the other end.
Could have been. Here's my thing, though. I'm actually okay with this, and I'm totally cool with it. I think it'll take people a little bit getting used to, generally, this idea, but I do think it's a way to save our kind of water problems that may occur in the future. And if we learn anything from Waterworld, it's that Kevin Costner can pee on a tree and drink it. Why can't we?
Sure.
Yeah.
Well,
if it's
you
good
know,
enough for Kevin Costner, you're going to say you're not as good as Kevin
right.
Costner.
Right. Okay. Who says that? Nobody says that.
Right.
I will say there's a little bias in that. Like for you know, for us, drinking water that used to be pee is like, oh, no, it's gross. For some people, it's like, you know, this is clean drinking water. We just recycled it from, you know, all the pee that everyone just had.
And there
some
are certain
people,
health nuts who advocate auto urine therapy.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't think it works, though.
No.
Well, I don't think science
you need,
is
you need to get rid of the ammonia.
Yeah.
Hey, let's move on to a non-pee story.
Great.
Captain Kipper sent us this one. The Internet Archive at archive.org has added 2,400 MS-DOS games to its library for you to play for free in a browser. Includes id Software's Commander Keen, RPG Wasteland, the original Prince of Persia, early FPS games like Wolfenstein 3D, a bunch more, 2,400 games.
Yeah, it's a huge selection. What's funny is some of these, though, will surprise people. They're not necessarily, I mean, I guess they're DOS games, but they're games like Street Fighter 2, which you would normally, you know, mostly consider an arcade game. Things like Dune 2, The Building of a Dynasty, which started out as a Genesis console game. A lot of examples like that. So if you're thinking you're just going to go over there and have a bunch of just crappy, you know, early 90s DOS throwaway that wasn't Doom or Quake, you'll be surprised how much stuff is here. Prince of Persia is awesome. The original Sin City is in here, like you said. Castle Wolfenstein, the original. I'm not talking like the id Software one, like the shooter. I'm talking like old school corridor crawling ancient Castle Wolfenstein. So yeah, it's totally worth doing this if you're at all a fan of that era of gaming. It's super rad.
And if you're like an abandonware nut, everything is running through a version of DOSBox.
Yeah.
So although I don't think you can customize like all the sound cards. One of the cool things about DOSBox, like if the standalone, is that you can add additions to the sound card. For example, one of the most sought after is the Roland MT32,
yeah,
which was the sound card that, I mean, basically it was a synthesizer on a card that you plugged, or not a synthesizer on a card, it was a synthesizer you plugged into your PC. And, you know, a lot of Sierra games, you know, the King's Quest, Space Quest, all had soundtracks specially written for that, and they sound incredible.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, for a lot of people who might be wondering or might be have a tinge of nostalgia for some old games, I don't see Art of War here. That was one of my favorite games from back way when.
Yeah, I don't see that one in here either. I was just looking through here, and that one didn't run through. It's interesting though. Some of these are going to let you use a joystick, which is I assume that works.
So yes.
It looks like you can use like a 360 controller on your PC or something. Oh, that's even better. I didn't even notice that earlier. That's amazing.
I mean, it's anyone who's used a joystick in the early PC era will remember that joysticks then kind of sucked.
Yeah.
And that was because PCs used analog pots to register joystick control movements, because the original joysticks that they built for them were for flight simulators and not arcade games.
Yeah.
And so they were very very fragile compared to a home console arcade stick. But, you know, I don't, maybe you remember this, Scott. Remember you had to calibrate your joystick before every game you played?
Yeah, it didn't matter what it was. You had to tell it what center was and up, down, right, all that. It was terrible. It was kind of an awful time.
And I was like, oh, this sucks.
It does
but you
suck.
Want to, you know, you want to play Ikari Warriors on your PC, you got to do that.
Yeah, I remember the original Donkey Kong port that, believe it or not, Nintendo put on PCs. There was actually an old Commodore 64 version too, I think. But the version I played was like 83 or something. Oh, here it is, in fact. Yeah.
Oh yeah.
And they've got that in here. This'll even let you configure joystick input. But I remember trying to get a joystick to work with that game, and it just was near impossible. And there weren't things like the internet to go to and like search around for everybody's solutions or how they hacked it in. You had to know somebody who knew a guy. And that's what this whole thing feels like to me, is like a walk through that kind of memory lane without some of the heartache. So yeah, totally worth checking out. Now, is this legal, Tom? Is this all legal? All this stuff?
Yeah, they either licensed it or researched, you know, whether it was out of copyright. Some of it is public domain, but they're covering all of that for the in-browser version of it. Now, if you were to download these things and run them yourselves, there might be different questions. I think all this stuff actually has. I'm sorry, I started playing Oregon Trail while you guys were talking.
that's a hard one.
Fat man.
Yeah, you can't do Oregon Trail and focus on anything.
I need to stop that right now. they'll have the copyright restrictions for each one of these to let you know what you can do with it.
It's cool.
They have Starflight. I love Starflight.
Oh, Starflight was great.
But you can't do this game. Well, they must have pulled out the copy protection in the game.
Why?
Because there's no way you can complete this game without the security code wheel.
Oh,
I don't remember, but when you bought the game, there was a little wheel and that was copy protection. It would give you a name that you would have to match up and then look in another window on the wheel to get the answer.
You're right. It was like a decoder ring kind of. And they had, there were other games that even had dongles, I remember. I can't remember any games that I off name, but I remember getting like a helicopter simulator and it had, I guess, a serial port dongle on it.
That
if you want to really research like what all went into creating this collection, you should go read Jason Scott's blog. He's the curator of the project. You can find it at ascii.textfiles.com. That's the name of his blog.
Nice. Wow, that guy's just our retro god this week. Good heavens.
He is.
Anyway, well, that's good stuff. Something else going on with Tom Wheeler. What's he up to?
Oh, Tom Wheeler. TV Zegon pointed out that Mr. Wheeler has set the date. He will propose on February 5th. Aw. And then the FCC will vote on February 26th on the proposed open internet guidelines. He said a lot more than just that, talking extensively about Title II, how it could be used to achieve no blocking, no throttling, and no paid prioritization without imposing rate regulation or discouraging investment. He backed off of actually saying they were going to propose Title II regulation, but it certainly sounded like it in his conversation with Gary Shapiro, who's the head of the CEA. Wheeler urged listeners to look at the wireless industry to see how the FCC might enforce Title II for ISPs.
Well, there you go. Thoughts, Roger?
You know, it's...
I mean, there's movement, right? There's something. It's no longer just... I feel like it's no longer just a room full of old men who don't get it. At least there's stuff on the table. There's concepts in play that are real, you know. Like, I don't know. I try to be positive about this, the outcome of this.
You know, where I've ended up with it is we are not going to get what we need, which is an entirely new set of rules created by people independent of an axe to grind that figure out like the lightest rules that we need to follow. That still needs to happen, but this kind of has to happen first.
Yeah.
Right. Like the political reality is this has to happen so people can start take pot shots at it so that we could see how bad or good it is and then triangulate from there. And maybe under the next president and the next Congress, we can get the momentum to create some kind of actual legislation that gives us an Internet Act, which isn't horrible. I know I'm talking pie in the sky here when I say like Congress making legislation that isn't horrible, but you know, the Telecommunications Act was done when the telephone came along. The Communications Act was done when cable came along. We need a new act that actually recognizes the realities of the internet. Now, a lot of you are like, no, we don't. We don't want Congress to get in on this because they'll ruin it. There is always the shred of a possibility that Congress could create a law that doesn't ruin it. They've done it before. I know it seems like very few instances, and maybe it's unlikely, but that is what needs to happen.
It's, you know, it's one of those things where you know, I would totally agree with Tom. I mean, it needs a ground up, you know, structure.
Don't get me wrong. It is, but that's what I think. That's what it needs. Mm.
But you know, one of the things is like conflict of interest. Being a provider as well as a being an internet provider, content provider. I mean, there's just. I mean, you look at it and you think like, you know, whatever happened to the antitrust acts of you know, the turn of the 20th century, because there is just so much vested money in everything. And you look at it, it's like, how does this even work to anyone outside of the stakeholders' interests? And it's, you know, this is a good step. If it's more than just talk, I'm very reluctant to be excited about it because I traditionally know how these things turn very slowly.
Mm.
We're
at such a complicated time when there's so many interests at play and it's going to be messy. I guess I'm just taking heart.
There's so much money.
Yeah.
And we all know money greases the wheels.
Yeah.
Except that it doesn't always grease it in your, you know, the public's favor.
Sure. Just greasy wheels is what you end up with.
And then you're on the Oregon Trail with greasy wheels. Speaking of greasy wheels, Mike P. Kennedy has a urine-free submission this time. Marvel Studios released the first teaser trailer for Ant-Man this week.
Yeah.
Paul Rudd plays Scott Lang, who teams up with Michael Douglas's Hank Pym, so we're getting them both, and then things get really small.
Yeah. What'd you guys think? What'd you think of the idea that they put out the mini trailer first, though? I want to gauge people's either irritation factor or how cute they thought that idea was, because I thought it was annoying.
I didn't really bother me. Yeah. Like, I've been reading up on it, so, you know, and I've seen the you know, exclusive screenshot of the trailer that might be coming out next year.
Yeah.
But what really bothers me is I can't take Paul Rudd seriously. I know it's sort of tongue-in-cheek, because the whole Ant-Man idea is very tongue-in-cheek.
Sure.
I'm wondering if, you know, if they'll follow along with the comics, or they'll do, you know, a kind of a rebooted version, or they'll do, like, a Marvel's Ultimate. You know, like, does he get in bed with the Wasp and, you know, all the other?
Well, the character he plays, Scott, is it Scott, not Campbell, whatever.
Scott Lang.
Is that it? Scott Lang? Yeah, that's it. That's a dude. That's a real dude that donned the suit at some point. So Hank Pym is old and is the, you know, guy passing the suit down, I suppose. Actually, we don't really know how they're going to present Hank Pym in this.
It does seem in the trailer like he's invented the suit and he wants to give it to Paul Rudd.
Yeah, it's time for him to pass on to a new guy. It reminds me of Batman Beyond or something where, you know.
Judy Greer is in this movie, so I feel like it's going to be a lighthearted take. I think they're trying to replicate Guardians of the Galaxy.
Sure.
It's definitely, they're going to have, I think the Avengers and all the other, like the Captain America movies will be their weightier, more, you know, more pensive movies. Well, like Guards of the Galaxy and Ant-Man. I mean, the title alone, it's like Ant-Man. Ooh, you know, it's funny because I know they did Giant Man in the comics where the suit sort of did it reverse and you got super large.
Yeah, yeah.
It'd be nice if they could do that at some point, but
that'd be all right.
You know, I was actually under the assumption that they would have done an Atom movie before an Ant-Man movie. And granted, it's a DC property. Have to go through Warner Brothers, but just like the whole concept.
I think there's
that
movie on that DC roadmap. Am I remembering that right?
I think you're thinking of Black Adam. I think
Black Adam. Villain,
yeah. Well, here's the thing with this, and what I think they're doing here. They're spending some of the currency they earned with Guardians of the Galaxy, which nobody thought you could make into a movie that would be a huge hit. I think people thought that was, you know, I think Feig knew it was going to be big, and the director and everybody else knew it was going to be big. But that was a real risk for Marvel to say, all right, we're going to take one of our weirder properties that, you know, what has a raccoon shooting people, and we're going to make that work somehow. And they totally did. I feel like Ant-Man is next in line to then say, yeah, and we can also make an Ant-Man people can take seriously, or at least strike a tone that works with viewers and a broad audience as well as fans of the comics. So
is it hubris?
It might be a little hubris. It could be. I mean, my biggest complaint about the trailer is it doesn't seem like the way the trailers worked leading up to Guardians. You were like, all right, they get it. They get the source material. They're leaning into that alternate cosmic Marvel space that is a little bit weird and kind of hard to swallow. And they're going to go for it. They're going to be funny about it. And just the music they used alone showed that they were willing to go there. This just feels straight up like it could be another Thor trailer or another Captain America trailer. And that's my only worry.
A lot slower paced, though.
Yeah.
Slower paced, but it doesn't really give you a sense. it does, it gives you a sense of a standard superhero movie. Like there's a great menace in that, you know, Paul Rudd needs to take up the mantle, and I still really have a hard time.
That does sound bad when you say that out loud. It sounds bad.
That's what I'm saying. It's like, yeah. So Paul Rudd comes in and he done what? Who?
I rode in an elevator with Paul Rudd once. He's a very nice man.
Oh, did you?
Was he a small man?
Yeah, he's got
He was average.
Really? I picture Seth, real like small.
Well, no. Scott would call him small because Scott's a giant.
Yeah, but, fair enough. Yeah. I picture a little tiny, like Tom Cruise-ish sized.
No,
okay.
Yeah, I wonder if Marvel's going to try Randy Deluxe's X-Men and Spider-Man rights back.
Yeah, well, that needs to. Yeah, we've talked a bunch about that. I don't know. I don't know why Marvel has earned so much credibility that it's very difficult for me to not be sure that they'll go ahead and get this right. But I don't like the tone of it thus far. I just don't think I want to see a serious take.
To be honest, you know, their successes have been on the small side. A lot of the movies have been just okay. Have just been okay.
But okay enough to be considered...
To do a sequel.
To do a sequel, right. And that's pretty good. I mean, that's good. I like your small... The small reference wasn't lost on me, though. That was nice. Well, all right. Well, there's all that. It's all very exciting stuff, everybody. Watch for that movie coming out. When is that? That's this year. When do we get that? Not spring, I guess.
Summer, right?
Summer, spring?
Something with an S.
Before, I think, I want to say it's sandwiched in between Avengers 2
and
Star Wars.
Wow, if only we had an interconnected network of computers that could tell us it was July 17th.
It's the summer.
Oh, it's my birthday.
Oh, no, it's going to be right.
Is it really? Oh, yeah, it is.
It's my freaking birthday, yeah. Maybe I'll have to go see it that day.
Happy birthday.
Happy birthday, everybody. All right, let's jump right into what we'd like to call the pop quiz.
America scores and wins.
It's time again, ladies and gentlemen, to subject our, in this case, guest to a pop quiz. Just for fun, they're competing against themselves. Normally we have multiple guests, and we'll continue to do that in the future, but Roger is his own worst enemy.
No guests, one guest, two guests, three guests. Yeah, we'll do
whatever the hell we want to do. Last week was just Tom and I. Just hanging out, talking about stuff.
We didn't do a pop quiz, though.
No, we did not.
Should have quizzed each other.
We should have.
Oh, I didn't know you had reading glasses, Tom.
I have to properly judge this, so I have my gavel and my reading glasses.
I love it. I like Tom and his glasses. All right.
They make bifocals.
Do they now? Is that a thing you can get? Let's see. Roger Chang, yours is CES trivia.
Oh, wow. Cool.
So historic look at the CES Consumer Electronics Show, and it begins here with this first question. What year was the first year CES was held?
1971.
You are incorrect. It was 1967.
The year in tech history, illustrated by Scott Johnson.
That's right. It's in there.
Oh, so wait. I need to. So this quiz, I need to buy something first.
Yeah.
It sounds like a lot.
Only if you want to win.
It's pretty sleazy. It's pretty sleazy. You got to scratch it off with a coin. There's not a very good chance you'll win. 1967 is the correct answer. Next one, from 1978 to 1994, CES was held twice a year. Oh man, remember that? What months did these events take place?
I would say May and then November.
You are incorrect. January, which stayed, and June was the other day.
You're going to get a half point, though, because you said, I would say, and it is in fact what you said.
Did they not, or did they do, have one in Vegas and then one in, was it Atlanta?
Chicago.
Oh, Chicago. Okay.
They started it in New York, which you can find out if you buy the Year in Tech History, illustrated by Scott Johnson.
Well, for the longest time, it was in Chicago.
Both times?
It was in Chicago.
Yeah, interesting. Yeah, I was actually there the summer of my graduation from high school in 1987.
Graduated in Chicago?
I'm old. No, I went there for my senior trip, and I think it was happening when I went, but that doesn't make sense if it was January, June. Well, anyway. In what year was the summer CES canceled because of the inaugural E3 show?
Not 2099.
You are incorrect. 1995.
You lose the half point I gave you earlier because they gave you the answer to this in the first question.
It's true, they did. Wait, did they?
The second question.
Second question.
The question was from 1978 through 1994.
Oh, right.
CES was held twice a year.
Right. That's a good job, Tom, for catching that. Who gave the opening keynote at CES 2008? It was notable. It was a big deal, too, because it's something he announced there.
I have no idea. I would have said. All I remember is Larry Page from 2007.
Oh wow! It was 2008. Was Bill Gates? He announced
him. Yeah, he gave the keynote every year.
Well, This was when he announced his stepping down from Microsoft that year. So it was a big. It was a big year. It's a notable one.
I really suck at CES.
What year did the VCR debut at CES?
1984.
Oh, I wish you were right, because that's when I remember it, but it was 1970. That was the debut. That would be like 1080p 4 years before you could buy it at Costco. It's like that. Third to last. Attendance dropped for the 2009 CES. How big of a drop in percentage did organizers say attendance dropped by?
30%.
You are so close, but so far, 22% is the correct answer.
I'm
going to give him 0.8 of a point because he had 80% of it.
That in the book? That was great. In what year did Microsoft? Sorry, that threw me for a loop. In what year did Microsoft announce they wouldn't be going to CES anymore?
2010.
Oh, so close. 2012.
Ah,
I know. Seems like yesterday.
You know, when you do 12 CESs, they all blur.
I was going to say, you have been to a lot of the ones in question.
And the other thing is, when Roger and I were going to CES most of the time, we were going and like doing things. We weren't paying attention to what was going on.
True.
It was like assignment to assignment to assignment.
This is true.
Totally a small aside, not to disrupt the quiz show, but this reminds me of a time when Patrick Stewart just says, "Forgive me when I mangle all the show episodes together from Star Trek Next Generation." We did a lot of them all at once.
Yeah.
And so I don't remember them individually the way you people
did. He say it at he said that probably at a convention, I'm guessing.
DragonCon.
Oh wow. All right. We'll take that, DragonCon. Final question. CES rose in popularity after what rival show was canceled? I went to one of these.
Comdex?
You are correct. Nicely done. It was Comdex.
It's not even really a rival show. Computer Dealers Expo.
It's true, but when that went away, CES exploded.
It was unintentionally a rival show.
Because
Everybody went from Comdex to CES at that point.
Yeah. I went to it in Vegas in 2000, and that wasn't that close to the last one. It was pretty close to that.
I think that was the last one.
It may have been the last one, yeah.
Yeah.
It was crazy.
It was either 2000 or 2001. But I think
we went twice. Because
I went in 2000 also.
Yeah. I went twice to it.
Oh, yeah.
And I remember the cab rides and the shows.
You were there? You were there
in
2000?
Yeah, in 2000 I was at Comdex.
Oh my gosh, I was there. Yeah. Do you remember? It was all about Sony's memory stick. That was like the big whoop. Ugh.
I remember Robert Herron filing a story by a USB thumb drive that I had to install a driver for in my Windows 98 laptop.
What? That's insane.
I remember.
He was like, I just found this thing and I'm using it. It's great. I'm not going to email you my story. You can just take it off this thumb drive.
Weird.
We had to do a stage show, and I had to help manage the stage.
Ugh, that sounds bad. But there it is. Congratulations. You have enjoyed yet another.
1.8 points.
1.8 points. That's not bad.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have known.
If it's a logarithmic scale, that'd be pretty cool.
There was
cool.
a point in the proceedings where I thought we might have our first zero. I was very, very worried.
Hey,
is what I'd say. All right, we have one last thing to do, and it starts with this.
The future promises even more startling things to come.
It's the part of the show we used to call it a show. It was called Forecast. Now it's a segment. We still call it Forecast. And this forecast, I think, is yours, Roger, is it not?
Yes, I put one in, but I wasn't sure if you guys, flipped the coin or something.
No, I like this one, but I'm going to do no justice to it, so explain your thoughts. It goes a little bit with what we talked at the top of the show, but I like this one, so go for it.
So my forecast is in the next 10 to 15 years. Again, with the continuing deflation that we're seeing in the Eurozone, and the continued waves of refugees and immigration from North Africa. I'm not sure if anyone's read up on the news about ghost ships that are literally colliding in Italy with Syrian refugees on board. There has been a noticeable uptick in the number in the amount of anti-immigration and anti-Eurozone rhetoric. And what I think is going to happen is that it's going to actually come to a point where a lot of quasi right-wing slash left-wing parties will be voted into office in some key countries, not across the board, but enough that would separate or at least fracture the Eurozone immensely. And as deflationary deflationary pressures continue and Russia gets sucked in, I can see Putin trying to do that one last gamble of, hey, you know what? I might as well just screw with the EU since they're so sanctimonious about me in Ukraine. I'm going to flood their countries with cheap firearms and ammunition, let them run havoc, run wild, and then I'll step in and say, hey, would you rather have someone strong in charge who knows what to do, or are you going to listen to the same people who've been telling you for the past 20 years that if you follow our road, everything's going to be great?
That seems bad.
It does. It sounds very conspiratorial, but that's my prediction. The next 10, 15, I'm not saying he's going to be successful, but he will position himself as the savior of Europe, not just Eurasia, but Europe.
A lot of dominoes have to fall in line for that prediction to actually come true, which is why I'm not sure it's actually going to come true. But I think elements of it are going to be reflected in reality, especially if you're talking more vaguely about Vladimir Putin positioning himself as sort of a champion of parties like, you know, UKIP and
Syriza, and then
I do think that the, you know, you're right, you're absolutely right that there's a growing popularity for these kind of parties. They're still not majority popular though, and I think the Greek election that's coming up is going to be very telling about how popular they are in one of the worst case scenarios, right? Even now, people are pretty sure Greek won't exit the Eurozone, but they've come close before, so anything's possible.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it really just goes to how much desperation there is in the population. When, you know, the larger countries aren't feeling it as much, but the smaller ones are, and generally they're kind of your barometer of how, you know, people feel, how things are going. In fact, you know, you've seen an increase in the number, the anti-Islam marches in Eastern Germany.
Yeah.
While those are happening, there is also lots of support for people who believe Islam. Which is, I think, unexpected. The French reaction, very similar to the Australian reaction, which is why I don't think it's, I don't get the feeling that now is the time where that anti-immigration sentiment sweeps the nations.
I disagree in so much that a lot of those types of marches have only been inhabited by neo-Nazi groups and super right-wing parties. Now you're seeing a growing number of middle-of-the-road people, people you would have never traditionally pegged as kind of being of that persuasion. And that tells me it's not that they – it tells me that there's something intrinsically happening to them, to people to kind of push them in that thing. And it's not to say that these people traditionally are going to be anti-immigration, but I think conditions are where, you know, when people feel stressed, they tend to make irrational actions because they're in a state of, you know, either great anxiety or a great deprivation, depending on, you know, what part of the place
I'm not disagreeing with any of the facts that you're saying. You're absolutely right about all of that, but it's a glass half full, glass half empty situation, right? All I'm saying is there's no answer. There's an answering faction saying no. You know, you are wrong about being anti-immigration. You are wrong about being anti-Islam. And I would be much more worried if that voice was very quiet or very limited, and it's not.
You know, but see, that's the thing, though. I think a lot of people make noise, and there was a great...
You can say the same about the anti-immigration crowd,
too. No, I know. But what I'm saying is that ultimately what's going to... You know, how you can tell, like you were saying, is with a lot of those... fringe countries, fringe EU, Eurozone countries, and how they decide, because, you know, again, they're going to be the barometer. They're the canary in the coal mine. I'm not saying, you know, that's my prediction. I'm not saying that everything's going to suddenly collapse in on itself and, you know, Europe is going to turn into a giant raging ball of fire. But it,
this is one of those classic East meets West conversations that Roger and I'll have where we'll both agree viciously with each other, because I'm the one going with the positive interpretation and Roger may be having the negative interpretation, or I may switch. I may be the negative interpretation it's sometimes very, Roger the positive.
You know, a lot of allusions have been made to, like, you know, the 1930s. And, you know, I'm not one of them where I see brown shirts running roughshod, but I do see people being a little more sympathetic to sides that they don't think they would have.
Oh yeah. It's worrisome that's happening at all.
And right? I think it's worrisome, not so much that it's great that people are standing up, but the fact that those negative voices are growing is what worries me. Mm. It's not that people are always going to protest, and I think that's a great thing. What worries me is the counter side is that other side is, you know, they're gaining traction in a way that I haven't seen since I was born.
Yeah, there's no question that all this stuff is weird, and there's already weird instabilities that didn't exist when we were born. Like, there's a lot of weird stuff going on over there. I am terrible at international sort of predicting anything, so this could be just as accurate as anything. But
this could be the final end of what was the Great War that was World War One, World War Two, the Cold War. I mean, people like to separate all that, but if you look at it on a timeline, it's literally one event, just stretched out over a very long period.
I would recommend people, seriously, I'm not saying this just to transition out of it, but that's why East Meets West is so fascinating, because dumb people like me can get really great info about real world issues like this at the East Meets West show, starring Tom Merritt and Roger Chang. They should check that out. Tom, where can they find that? I forget.
Let me just say that we don't do any research or preparation for the show, so I don't want to overpromise.
I think that's why I like it.
You can find it at subbrilliant.com/EMW.
Yeah, and it's all iTunes is where I got my, I get it. Everyone will get it everywhere, but it's great.
Not academics.
No, but it's great, and it's fun. They're fun opinions, and people should check it out. Speaking of which, Roger, as always, a pleasure to have you on the show. What is going on with you that people can find and see and do right now?
Best way to track me is on Twitter, at Jolly Roger, JOLLY Roger. You will occasionally see my sometimes witty but most often retweets of very interesting stories that I come across.
Very nice. I always think of you as that guy I'm mad at on Steam, because it shows that you own every game. Yeah. I look at
I don't actually own it. It's that it's a very long story.
It's a press thing, right? Like some kind of press
I got a press account. And originally I thought I
wouldn't understand.
Well, no, originally I thought it was a press account to Valve's games.
Yeah.
Right. I just needed, you know, I just wanted to test out their Steam service. I asked Grace if I could get a press account. I thought it would just be like, you know, Left 4 Dead 2 and, you know, Half-Life 2 and all that. I didn't realize it was every game in the Steam library.
Everything ever released, ever that has been released or will be released. Roger's name is right there staring at me. It's killing me. Every time I go in there. All right, but it's good to be your Steam friend nonetheless. So do check out Roger on Twitter. Tom, anything before we go, sir?
Ladies and gentlemen, I know a lot of you enjoy hearing Scott and I talk about this stuff every week with our various guests. I would like to have Scott on Daily Tech News Show more often. If you would like to have that as well, please help us reach our new goal on the Patreon at patreon.com/acedetect. That's A-C-E-D-T-E-C-T. Or you can go to bit.ly/helpdtns. We have a goal to get Scott and Ms. Veronica Belmont on as regular contributors. So if you can, if you want that, you can afford it, and you feel like the show is valuable, go check that out.
Yeah. Who doesn't want that, really, at the end of the day?
There's a few.
There's maybe a few. There's probably always a few. Very exciting stuff. There's plenty happening on the Frog Pants Network as well. If you'd like to go check that out at frogpants.com, lots of shows, lots of content, lots of entertainment. We have dates for Nerdtacular 2015. They are currently the 30th, 31st of July, and the 1st of August. And we're very excited about that. More news coming if you would like to attend. I think it's going to do it for us. Current Geek. Current Geek. You'll be there. Current Geek on Twitter. Scott Johnson on Twitter. Ace Detect on Twitter, currentgeek.reddit.com, currentgeek@gmail.com, and currentgeek.com is the website. We'll see you guys next week for a whole new episode. Bye.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we take a look at so-called promiscuous licensors and what trademark owners can do to protect themselves from losing their IP rights by being labeled as promiscuous. A Michigan court hit the legal news cycle in September for deciding a trademark case based on the well-established doctrine that so-called naked licensing by a trademark owner can destroy those trademark rights. Naked licensing is understood to mean the situation where a trademark owner licenses the rights to use the trademark to another party without exerting some control over the quality of goods and the use of the mark by the third party. This practice is disfavored in trademark law because trademarks are designed for the primary purpose of avoiding consumer confusion by properly identifying the source of well-known trademarked goods. It logically follows that if a company allows others to use that trademark without exerting any real quality control over the use of the mark, then the line blurs for consumers about where the source of goods bearing that trademark is located. Returning to the Michigan case, a company called Movie Mania was suing to stop a rental service competitor from using their trademark, but the court discovered that Movie Mania had licensed the rights to use this trademark in many agreements since 1996 without any quality control provisions. Thus, these naked licenses ruined any trademark rights Movie Mania had to its own company name, and the competitor won the case and the right to continue using this mark. The naked licensing was deemed by the court to make Movie Mania a so-called promiscuous licensor, a cute play on words that helped this case become a bigger news item. One of my regular day job duties as an attorney is to review publishing and distribution agreements for video and board game designers. Almost every single time, the license-granting language in these game design contracts for the use of copyrighted and trademarked material contains no real provision for quality control. This is very bad, as signing such an agreement could wreck one of the client's most important business assets, specifically the trademark rights. The bottom line is, just like most IP rights, trademark law has some quirks which can lead the uninformed to make bad decisions that could kill assets like trademarks. Be careful out there, as you don't want to end up being the next naked and promiscuous party we hear about in the legal news. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions as segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This podcast is part of the Frog Pants Studios Network. For more information about this and other shows, visit frogpants.com. Audio program so good, it's like you're there.